where and when you were born.
Well, I was born in South London on the 5th of July 1928, and in Lea Green, South London.
What were the names of your parents?
My mother is still alive and kicking. She's 87 this year. But my father died, his name was Thomas. He died 14 years ago now. And my mother's name is Amy. And she's remained very fit, with the exception of her eyes that are a bit dodgy at the moment.
Where did they send you to school?
Well, I started off in an infant school just across the road from where I lived in South London. And subsequently, we moved from time to time, as people do. And I went to Rathfern Road School in Catford. And I was there when the war broke out in 1939, and I was evacuated with the school down to Ewhurst in Kent, and then I was Ewhurst in Surrey, I think it was, yeah, Surrey, and then subsequently came back to Catford Central School in London at the height of the Blitz, and so that in my entry in Journalist Who's Who it says, educated in Catford Central School, mainly in the bomb shelters. That basically is true. And from then on, I imagine you want to know how the career started, yes, as it were. Well, an uncle of mine worked at St Clement's Press, which was a subsidiary of Financial Times. And he got me a job on the Financial Times as a clerk in the accounts department.
About when was that?
1943, yeah. And we used to travel up to work on the trains then from South London with along Doodlebug Alley, as it was called. And the doodlebugs, or the flying bombs, used to follow the trains up and fall either side of the train. But since we were in a situation where there were young lads and girls together, we didn't seem to mind too much at the time. Looking back, it's quite ironic, actually. But anyway, I started the Financial Times, rather Dickensian office, sitting at a high chair and stamping invoices. And I progressed a little up the ladder in the on the account side, and then I went into the REF in, when was that, 1940. Six. I was supposed to do 2 years in the RAF as a national serviceman, but the day I was due to be demobilised, which was in July 48, all demobilisation was stopped because of the onset of the Berlin airlift. And the problem at the time, where you know, they thought we might be at war with Russia. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I did another 6 months as a result of that, and came out of the Air Force, went back to the Financial Times, and started, told them I didn't want to go in the accounts department, and I went into the Investment Inquiry Bureau, where in those days the Financial Times ran this very good bureau which used to advise small investors particularly on buying and selling stocks and shares. And we had a couple of experts there, and my job at the time was merely, I was quite a good typist, and the idea was to write letters to all the small investors who wrote in, giving them advice on stocks and shares. And in those days, we used to tip rubber plantation shares at a penny. This was just after the war, when the plantations had been ravaged by the Japanese and the war out there. And of course, the shares were virtually worthless, but subsequently became worth a lot of money. So, and I did this stint in the Investment Inquiry Bureau of the Financial Times, and then asked to be changed over to the, I wanted to become a journalist. So I saw the editor, Sir Gordon Newton, and, excuse me, he put me into the prices room, which is the basic department of all stock exchange affairs, learning about stock exchange prices, the movements. And those days we used to prepare the prices for the back page of the Financial Times, together with yields and things. And from there, I progressed into the market room and became a junior market reporter, where we used to write, take various sectors of the market, say engineers or stores, concentrate on those two or three particular departments of the market, and write little pieces in the Financial Times Market Report, which at the time, and still is to some extent, the Bible. And I progressed up the ladder there until I became second in command. And then in 1959, I was offered the job as stock markets correspondent of the Daily Telegraph by the then doyen of the city, Francis Whitmore. And I took it, and basically the rest is history. I've been there ever since, 31 years this December.
Who were the people who you'd worked for in the investment inquiry department in the FT? Who were the experts at the time?
Don Ryder. Don Ryder went on to become chairman of British Leyland and Reed International. And Robert Smythe, who went on to become a top stockbroker. And the last I heard of him, he was retired on Gozo. But those were fun days, and it was one used to get a real kick out of getting letters back from the small investors who'd made money from these recommendations, and used to write in to say thank you. Doesn't always happen, of course.
Where would you be getting your information to recommend stocks? Because, you mentioned tips, but I'm sure you don't quite mean the same thing as the Sunday tipsters who occasionally were a bit notorious.
Yes, the stock market is all about having information, hopefully knowing something the other guy doesn't know. But it all comes down to real study of individual companies, looking at the background and saying to yourself they're in the right sort of industry to progress and grow, and looking at that particular sector and then studying individual companies and looking at their recent record and perhaps what the chairman's saying about the current year's trading and so on. And then taking a view and saying on that basis, all things being equal, the shares are reasonably priced or even cheap. Now nothing has changed. That was in those early days and it remains the same today. So basically, you've got to do your homework when you're looking at stocks and shares. It's not easy to make money in the market. Some people thought it was and is, but it isn't anymore. And it really wasn't at any time. But of course, now we've got the insider trading laws and things that makes it much more difficult for the sort of spivvy punters, as some people refer them to. But you've got to remember that those spivvy punters, so-called, I would call the professional investor who used to deal perhaps five or six times a day in things which he fancied to move up. The fact that the market has changed so much means that that man has largely disappeared. And in my view, that means the market has largely disappeared.
Did you regard what you were doing as quite different to, say, the tipping in a Sunday paper, or was that more or less the same thing? Because it wasn't unheard of for someone to know about what was being printed in the Sunday press a few days before.
It was notorious for that. And there were certain brokers in the market at the time, I mean it's no secret, that had contacts there. And they would deal on the basis, but would also let the jobbers know at the time. They wouldn't tell them directly, but people got to know these things, and it was the regulars would come round, so the jobbers would be prepared, if you like, and they weren't too upset as a result.
Did the standards change after a while, or did that kind of flow of information sort of continue right up to?
Well, things obviously had to tighten up. We found, talking purely from my own job and the Daily Telegraph, we've always had a tight security system. When you've got, the problem was really with weekly newspapers, where copy was going down to the printer two or three days before it was actually came out in the streets. And then you get a situation where perhaps somebody in the printing department would tell a friend, and another he would tell another friend, and they're the leaks. It was very difficult to stop it, but certainly there's been a tremendous tightening up of that situation, and you rarely get a stock exchange inquiry now based on a newspaper article or a leak, or what is said to be a leak in a newspaper article, because the security is now very good.
Can you describe in a bit more detail what the prices room did and how you actually went about getting the closing prices to print in the paper the following day?
Well, there again, things have changed dramatically. But in the old days, I mean, we used to get the prices over the little ticker tapes. And those would be processed. We used to take the ticker tapes and literally write them out in longhand. And obviously, in the early days, on the Financial Times particularly, although it covered, it printed the biggest number of prices of any paper, it was still small relative to what it is today. Now there's bigger staff, the computers and so on, and we get information direct from the stock exchange fed into our computers on the share prices. So it's automatic these days. But until Big Bang, and until the onset of the screen trading, I as a stock market correspondent had tremendous difficulty getting late information and up-to-date information, the same as every other stock market correspondent at the time, because things used to change quite dramatically, sometimes at 5:30 in the evening, and many papers would have the wrong prices in as the result. Now it was my job to check around and get the latest, the late features, and get the right prices in the paper. Some you win, some you lose in a situation like that. And the position was never perfect for anybody. But nowadays, with the computer screens and the stock market closing at 4:30, we've got a much better chance of getting everything accurate. And the stock exchange itself sends out the prices to our computers, and they're printed up. So more or less, the prices are in the same in all the papers now, because we all take the service.
How did you?
Excuse me.
That's all right.
Sorry about that.
I can press the pause button whenever you.
Right. Sorry.
How did you go about getting the late stories?
Personal contacts. It's the same. I mean, I've been around a long time in the city. I know a lot of people in the city, dealing rooms, head of market making and so on, and also many, many so-called captains of industry, chairman of public companies who I got to know over the years, and who build up a position of trust with some people in the press, and you sort of work it from there. You get sometimes just a gut feeling about a certain share, which you see moving, and something clicks in the back of your mind, and you say, "Now I remember something happened there 2 years ago that could be relevant to what's happening today." So you get the file out or the cards and so on and look it up. And that brings back your memory. And sometimes history repeats itself like that.
Did the jobbers figure in this sort of information network for you?
Yes, I mean, under the old jobbing system, when we were all on the stock floor of the stock exchange, and I actually had the privilege of being on the floor of the stock exchange for 26 years, and that was a special privilege accorded to me by the Council of the Stock Exchange, and it arose from my predecessor, a chap named Turner, who during the war was standing outside the stock exchange interviewing the jobbers as they came out, saying, "What's been going on today? Can you give me a line for the paper?" Blah, blah, blah. And one day there was a tremendous air raid on, and there was shrapnel falling, and they said, "Oh, Turner, for God's sake, come inside." And it established a precedent for the Telegraph. And when Turner retired and I took over, the Stock Exchange Council interviewed me and said, "Now, you know, you've got to abide by our rules, naturally, and you mustn't deal, and you mustn't look at the private members board, at least not communicate it to people outside." And I agreed to abide by the rules, and for that reason they allowed me to continue for 26 years. And I built up a certain reputation of being trustworthy and so on as a result. But talking, looking at the jobbing system as it was then, I mean, for a broker particularly, and for me as an outsider really, just as a market reporter, I could talk to the jobbers on the floor of the house and to see things happening as they happened. And you had a certain feeling and knowledge about people who were wandering around trading. I personally feel that the onset of Big Bang, while it's been tremendously useful in building up the stock exchange reputation as an international trading centre, has been very has been a disappointment, especially for the smaller investor, because he cannot now trade in the way he used to. Where previously he would instruct his broker to buy or sell a certain share, his broker would go onto the market floor and find a jobber in that particular stock, and he had the choice of several. And he would ask that jobber what the price was, and he would say thank you very much, remembering that jobber didn't know whether the broker was a buyer or a seller. And that broker would go around to the other jobbers and check the market, because it was his job to get the best price possible for his client, whether he was buying or selling. And he would go around and he'd go back to what he considered was the best price, and he would deal on that basis. And it was all friendly, and it was marked down in the book, and if there were any queries, it was sorted out. And it was strictly my word is my bond. And there was the camaraderie of the market floor and the situation where, when you knew a jobber very well, you could chivvy him into giving you a bit more for your stock or charging you a little less for it. And there was this friendly atmosphere. I'm afraid most of that has gone these days, because you can't be friendly with a computer screen. But that is the main difference, and I think the small investor has lost out, and this has been reflected in the dropping away of the small investment business. And I get lots and lots of letters from small investors who are still very interested in the market, but they've been completely disillusioned by especially the fate of the smaller companies, where share prices have crashed because there is no market in them and nobody knows quite what to do. And a lot of people are locked in. And the dealers in the smaller companies, the market makers in the smaller companies, they can't find enough business to maintain a reasonable price level. So,
Can you please? Yes. Were there any other journalists who were allowed to go onto the floor of the stock exchange?
A lot of people say I was the only journalist on the floor of the stock exchange, but that's not quite true, because the Financial Times had several chaps on the floor who used to collect prices. This is before the onset of Big Bang. And they were also market reporters in their own right. But it's probably fair to say that I was the most recognised one on the floor, because I had a blue button with a firm of brokers for many years. But everybody knew that I didn't do any work for the brokers. They knew I was the Daily Telegraph man and treated me accordingly. Sometimes ignored me accordingly. But that was par for the course.
How do you contrast the stock exchange as a marketplace, physical place, in the early, was it the early 60s when you went in, with, say, immediately before Big Bang?
Well, we had the three changes, of course. We had the old stock market floor, where we were all allowed to light up cigarettes at 3:15 in the afternoon when the waiter did his rattle to tell us we could smoke. And of course, many people used to smoke those days, not so these days. But that was the old stock market floor, very old building, of course, lovely traditions in there I'm just trying to think of the actual physical background of it. It was crowded, it was dirty by and large, although they made every effort to keep it clean. It was that the sort of place that would get dirty. And then, of course, preparatory to moving into the new building, we went onto a temporary market floor, and then into the stock exchange floor as it existed up until Big Bang, which was superb because it was air conditioned, it was clean, no smoking allowed. everywhere you looked, there was excellent information, what the time was, and probably in New York and so on, all around the world, things that could be viewed from the public gallery. And the public gallery, of course, was a very extreme success, and people are still going there, I understand, although there's not much to see these days. And we transformed from a dirty but very pleasant working environment into a very clean and still very pleasant, but more clinical environment.
Did you find the way people behaved had changed?
No. People did not change until the onset of Big Bang, where we had a new breed of young entrepreneurial men coming into the market who paid a great deal of money, as you know, they were when the things were set up in the first instance. And when everybody thought there was a lot of money to be made in the new International Stock Exchange, in dealing terms. And of course, history has told us there were too many cooks spoil the broth. But until the market floor closed, you still had that wonderful atmosphere where you had a laugh and a joke, a situation where they played the fool when there wasn't much business, the old idea of buying a box of chocolates outside, eating the chocolates, then placing the box of chocolates on the market floor with water in it until some idiot came along and kicked it, which always happened. And the idiot would, of course, get a soaked foot. And silly things like that. But it was all part of the makeup and the friendliness of the stock market floor, which unfortunately has now disappeared.
What was your daily routine like pre-Big Bang?
My daily routine was I used to get go into the market floor soon after the opening, which at that time was 9:30, and have a good look round, talk to a few people, say what's going on, what sort of things should I keep an eye on today. Then I'd report back to my office, to office conference, noon. And then having had a snippet of lunch, I'd go back onto the market floor until 3:30. And after that, by 3:30, you've got a good, you walk round and remember that there was sort of obvious things going on price boards, because in those days they marked the price boards up in yellow and red, in blue and red. And if you saw a big string of blue or a big string of red as walking around the floor, you immediately wanted to know why, so you'd ask the jobber. Sometimes he'd be friendly and tell you, and other times he'd say, don't want to say too much at this time or whatever. But generally speaking, they're extremely helpful and usually found a reason for it, which you could communicate to your readers on the following day.
How reliable were these price boards?
Generally speaking, quite reliable, but you've got to remember, if those jobbers who were changing the prices all the time, particularly if the market was busy, and in those days it used to be very busy at times, and you'd have to queue up to talk to the particular guy you wanted to deal with, he wouldn't always have time to write the prices up right up to date. He would always make sure at the end of the day it was right, so that it could be transferred by his blue button in the morning to show you the starting price. But, in the days of, for instance, the Australian boom, the Poseidon affair, it's known as, it was absolutely incredible. They just couldn't, they were so busy and the market was so wild, prices were jumping sometimes by a pound a minute. And nobody really knew why, except that people were speculating and buying them. And of course, we all know what happened to the Australian boom. But it was fascinating and tremendous fun, because it was action, and it certainly kept the brain cells from drying every day, because you were so mentally stimulated.
Were there particular firms or particular jobbers who you had a good relationship with and generally could rely on?
Well, there were. Obviously, you make particular friends over the years, and there were certain jobbing firms where I would always go, because I would know that I'd get a friendly reception. And more often than not, they would answer my questions sensibly and and we got on like that. And sometimes, of course, the job would say to me, have you had a look at such and such a share recently? And I'd say, no, and what about, it might make an idea for your tailpiece, which is my little tipster column that I do every day. And I'd go back to the office and I'd get the file out in the company and I'd have a look at it. And if I agreed with his views, I might well write a little tailpiece on that. Mm. I mean,
by the early 60s, the mergers among jobbing firms had already started, but there were still a far greater number of jobbing firms in the stock exchange than there were subsequently. How would you contrast the jobbing system when you first went into the market with the early 1980s? Did you still have sort of small one-man or two-man firms?
You certainly did. I recall particularly in the CAFA market, as it was called, the gold share market, there were quite a number of one- and two-men firms who would have a tiny little pitch against a wall tucked away somewhere where you could always go and say, good morning, how are you today, and what so-and-so shares. And he, being a small man, he might be well prepared to give you a slightly different price than somebody else if you were a small dealer. And those people used to live on small investment business, and the brokers knew them for what they were and dealt accordingly. And also there was the friendliness of the situation, and people used to say, well, we'll give so-and-so a turn this morning because he was very good last time and hasn't had much business. He'd been standing there all day doing nothing. Let's help him out. And this was the camaraderie that I was talking about before, and that things have changed so much. I mean, it's all about big business, big money nowadays. And the big firms are certainly going to come out on top in international trading terms in the forthcoming battles with the Americans and the Japanese and so on and so forth, because I think London will remain the capital of the world in terms of trading. But there are still too many cooks in the market. Most people recognise the number of market makers at the moment cannot exist. There isn't enough business to go round. And looking ahead, it's hard to see there will be enough business, because we have problems coming up like general election uncertainties and so on and so forth. And Wall Street looks pretty toppy, and people are worried about a possible crack there. So that one cannot see that business is going to improve sufficiently, the volume is going to improve sufficiently to justify the current number of market makers. And I mean, anybody in the stock exchange will tell you that they all agree, but they're all reluctant to be the first to go, as it were.
You mentioned earlier CAFAs. Yeah. Did the different markets in the stock exchange then have a different character?
Oh, yes. I mean, they were identified by the pitches, and after you'd been on the market floor for some time, you could immediately identify in your mind if somebody asked you for a particular share, whether it was an engineering share, you knew which section in the market to go to, the geographical section of the market to go to. So that stopped you, if you were experienced, from wandering from one side of the big room to the other, because you knew immediately where those certain jobbers in those certain shares were. Mm. That came with experience. The character of the markets were usually identified with the sort of nature of the particular business in which companies were involved. I mean, gold mining shares, by their very nature, and oil shares, are speculative investments in the sense that companies invest lots of money digging holes in ground without any real knowledge that the money they're spending will be returned. Obviously, an oil company who's drilling a well is hopeful of getting a gusher, in which case its investment will be repaid many times over. Same applies to a gold mining company or any company like that. Whereas the other end of the scale, you know that an industrial company trading, say, in the engineering sector or the motor industry, you can see what the general economic situation is at the moment, and therefore you can get a very good idea in your mind how things are going to go in that particular industry, and you invest accordingly. And if you think that things are going to go over the top and the economy is going to turn down to the disadvantage of, say, the motor industry, you used to sell your motor shares mm. and switch to something else which looked more promising at the time.
How would you... did jobbing firms have a distinctive character, distinctive identity? I mean, for example, some firms were known to be traders and to turn over stock very rapidly. Other firms were known to be, equity jobbers were sometimes seen to be a bit different from the gilt jobbers, who were a bit more slower moving, a bit more staid. Does that ring any bells?
Gilt jobbers staid, perhaps, is the wrong expression, because although they were often described as such, the gilt market is a huge market and is always rapidly moving, and the jobbers in gilt certainly didn't have to be stayed, they had to remain on their toes all the time. But the big firms who sort of dominated the gilt market were certainly in that character, in the sense that they weren't regarded as speculative. You didn't have a broker of that sort or a jobber of that sort